Shayna, my dear.
Christopher, my love.
Today's show, just to remind you,
yes,
is one in our signature series of climate dialogues. We're going to do some special promotion of this special series. So we think, as we build our show, Shayna, that these climate dialogues will be reaching some new people.
We're hoping to have new listeners, yes. Excellent. So what do you want these new listeners to know, Chris?
What I want you to help me remember, Shayna, is three things to ask these new listeners. One is to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at What in Gods. The second thing I want you to help me remember is to invite people to get on our mailing list so we can stay in touch. And people can do that at our website, whatingods.com.
Yes.
And the third thing that we invite people to do is share our show with your people.
Okay, let me see if I got it. Chris, one, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at What in Gods. Two, sign up for our mailing list. And three, share the show with your friends.
Oh, thank you. You're going to help me remember by having reiterated that. I appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, now that I've got it clipped into my head.
If you are listening to What in God's Name for the first time, we think we have something special to offer for our shared common life that is unique in approach and unique in execution. People tell us our show is refreshing and needed. As we aim to reframe public conversations from the economic and the political to the theological and the moral, so as to lift up our key phrase, human flourishing.
Amen.
Love it.
So, Chris, let's get going with our second in the signature series regarding climate dialogues featuring Abigail Andre and Susan Hoffman Fishman.
Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are on a mission to recast the stories we tell ourselves about our shared common life together using theology and moral philosophy and the riches of the humanities. Why, Shayna?
To get beyond the binaries of the political and the economical, which define so much of the conversation in our public square. And, you know, have nothing to do with human flourishing, so there's that.
We have two special guests with us today, Abigail Andre and Susan Hoffman Fishman. As part of our continuing series on the climate crisis.
Hey, Chris, before we launch into our guests, can you know, we're always inviting people to contribute on Patreon so that they can have exclusive access to, you know, shows like this. And today we actually have one of our Patreon contributors with us. So nice to see your face, Sarah.
Thank you.
And should we let folks know that Brandon is also with us today, is on this recording, our producer, Brandon Edwards. So nice to have you with us today, Brandon.
It's lovely to be a part of this and to be a part of these recordings, and good to see everybody here today.
Susan Hoffman Fishman is a mixed media painter, public artist, and arts writer whose work has been exhibited widely in museums and galleries throughout the United States. Her latest bodies of work focus on water and the climate crisis. Rising tides, plastic oceans, the threat of water wars, and most recently, rampikes, dead trees along our shores whose roots have been exposed to salt water from rising tides. With her monthly column, which is called Imagining Water, Fishman is a regular contributor to the international blog Artists and Climate Change that documents the work of visual artists, playwrights, novelists, poets, dancers, public artists, musicians, and performers around the world who are focusing on the critical topic of climate change. You can find out more about Susan Hoffman Fishman and see her art at SusanHoffmanFishman.com. Susan, it's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Chris.
And our second guest, Professor Abigail Andre. Abigail Andre joined the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School after 10 years of environmental litigation with the U.S. Department of Justice. From 2010 to 2016, Professor Andre Abigail helped litigate the case against British Petroleum and others arising from the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Abigail received the Attorney General's Distinguished Service Award in 2016 for her work on that case. And Abigail Andre has a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Painting and Sculpture from the University of Colorado in Boulder, which is why we chose her and sought her out for this conversation today. Abby, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I should also add that her art can be found at abbyeandre.wixsite.com. Just to get us grounded, I want to give each of you a chance to say more about your work on climate change. And if you would, we would love to hear more about your motivation to do the work you do. What is the passion that drives your work? What is the desire behind what you do? And Abby, let's start with you.
That's a big question. I think first, I'll describe a little bit what I do with the clinic. Clinical education at a law school gives students the opportunity to participate in cases as though they were at a little law firm. And so the Environmental Advocacy Clinic does a lot of work surrounding major environmental statutes, but increasingly climate change, and how to facilitate things like transition to more sustainable energy sources. So permits for wind, solar, things like that. But also more largely how to address the disproportionate impact of climate change on low-income communities, BIPOC communities, and address those in a way that is community-centric and really try as advocates to put the needs and stories of those who are most impacted by climate change at the center of what we do. As for the why, from the perspective of a lawyer, I've always been interested in giving voice to not necessarily the voiceless, but those who don't have the tools or the political will to protect themselves. And in that way, environmental law was something I was naturally drawn to. And for any environmental lawyer who works on environmental protectionism, climate change is the only issue that matters. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that it's the issue of our generation and certainly my children's generation. And so it's really become this sole focus of what I do right now.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Susan, your turn.
I guess I would add, in terms of biographical information, some of my most recent projects, because I think they're what is on my mind. Currently, I have an exhibition up at the Five Points Gallery in Torrington, Connecticut. And the exhibition is called, In the Beginning, There Was Only Water. And it reframes the biblical creation myth in which man, in quotes, was granted dominion over all the earth's plants and animals. And I've recreated that narrative into a new non-human-centric story. And it's comprised of 39 mixed media paintings on paper, which together measure around 50 feet. It begins when the 3.8 billion years ago, when our planet started to cool and rains began to fall and filled up the basins that eventually became the primeval ocean. And in the beginning, there really was only water. And why I decided to do this project was because there is this growing sense among, well, certainly among artists, but also among thinkers, that the basic challenge that we have in terms of the climate crisis for artists and storytellers is how do we restore voice to non-humans? Because we have become so separated from the non-human world, and it's allowed us to do what we have done to the planet. The other, I guess, project is an artist in residency at Planet Labs in San Francisco, and this is a virtual residency because of COVID. And what I'm doing there is I'm looking at satellite imagery of the Dead Sea. And one of the reasons I am, well, the reason I am doing that is because I have learned about the proliferation of about 6,000 sinkholes that have developed around the Dead Sea as the sea shrinks in size and the earth collapses. And to me, it's a significant demonstration of how the earth is responding to what we have done to it and is breaking. In terms of my motivations, I'd say I have three of them. One is that it's very clear to me that the most important existential threat to our survival on this planet is climate change. And I don't think, you know, any artist who is consciously working on current issues can avoid working on that. I'm also kind of horrified, you know, at everything that's happening to the species on this world and to the pollution of our waterways and oceans. And it's scary. So I guess I could say I'm motivated by fear as well. And certainly by, you know, my desire for my granddaughter to grow up in a world that is healthy.
That's great. Thank you for sharing all that, Susan. Chris, did you have a question to go with, or were you going to throw it my way?
I can go either way, Shana.
I heard that about you. Go ahead.
Go for it.
Go ahead.
Okay.
I can hold on to my question.
So I can go one of two ways with this. One thing I was struck by when both of you spoke was both used the word voice and giving voice. And so, all right, so let's go there. I hear that and I think power. Who has whose voice is heard is the powerful voice, and whose voice is not heard is relatively without power, at least in the current configurations. So I am curious, again, because we've paired a lawyer with an artist. And so, Abigail, you're going to need to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think about the power of law as being a coercive power. And I think of the power of art as being a persuasive power I'll just leave the distinction at that. So I would love to reflect on voice and voicelessness and power. Susan, let's start with you as the artist.
People don't normally think in terms of art having power, but in some ways it certainly does. And its power is its ability to engage the senses and emotions, you know, in ways that data, you know, cannot. And I know that a lot of scientists and environmentalists and politicians have tried to influence the thinking of the people in their countries with data, and it doesn't seem to work. People are mostly responsive to images and to the emotions that these images evoke. So I would say its power is in its ability to reach people in a way that other disciplines cannot.
Thank you, Susan. Abby, how about you as a lawyer?
I would say that the law certainly has coercive power, but that the best legal thinkers, the most influential legal minds, know how to persuade. And that when politicians stop trying to persuade the public and become engulfed in their own ideologies and theories about how things should happen. They're political factions, they're re-election campaigns. They lose the power of the persuasive legal argument. And that's really where the law can be used to inspire, to tell stories, and to promote change. And I think one thing that struck a chord with me, Susan, about an opportunity that I think we miss as lawyers and when we talk about how we use data, how we try to persuade, can be so devoid of emotion and human connection and grounding in the real world impact of what a law is trying to do. And so it's tricky when you're talking about how to wield power. I think we often, as lawyers and people in power, often are lawyers, forget that what the laws are for is to protect people and their communities, which of course flow from that, protect our natural resources and the earth for its own sake. So there is, in my mind, a lot of squandering of power and missed opportunities with power when it comes to climate change and the law. And some of that comes from a lack of political will, and some of it comes from a real failure of communication and connection. We've made it a blue and red issue, and it's really to everyone's detriment and risk that we've chosen to make it political instead of true.
You are listening to What in God's Name. Our guests on this climate dialogue are Susan Hoffman Fishman, visual artist and climate activist, and Abigail Andre, environmental lawyer and professor at Vermont Law School. If you like what you are hearing, please consider sharing this show via email or social media and join us in the project of enriching our public conversations. You can join us and be sure not to miss any of our work by signing up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com. That's one word, whatingods.com. And now, back to our climate dialogue with Susan and Abby.
I also was struck by how both of you were engaged in the work of giving voice to or getting stuff out of the way so that voices that haven't been heard can be heard. And I was curious, I mean, just on behalf of our listeners and myself, you know, how do you do that from your respective, you know, your respective professions? How would you begin to give voice to that which does not have a voice that we even recognize, you know? And then I guess the question isn't that different when you're talking about the BIPOC community, because I think for a lot of people, the voice of BIPOC people is not something that they are remotely familiar with and have no idea why it would sound any different from their own. So I was just curious about that.
Your question touches on an evolution in environmental law that's happening right now, which Susan's work that she's doing right now really reminded me of. So in the beginning of the environmental law movement in the 1970s, mostly, to be crass and blunt, white guys wrote laws to protect stuff that they liked. And so you have the Clean Water Act, Superfund, Clean Air Act, and yes, there was general recognition that there was some value to those resources, but largely the focus was on the value to us. And so the idea of dominion is really reflected in our current environmental framework, which benefits the powerful, the wealthy, those who can afford to bring cases, those who even know how to go about finding a lawyer and become a client. So one of the ways that we've traditionally given voice to the voiceless is us lawyers on our steeds have gone and identified problems that we think need solving and rescued clients, right? And brought cases. And there was a lot of value in that for a long time. And it helped create a body of law that defines kind of the contours of environmental law in this country. And we still need that type of lawyering that is kind of lawyer focused. But increasingly, the environmental movement is shifting towards telling the stories of the disenfranchised from their own perspectives, rather than from my perspective, or the perspective of others who are at least educationally privileged, but probably also financially privileged, and privileged in other kind of countless ways. So how do you do that? Well, it used to be that you would have to go to the places that were being negatively impacted by whether it's climate change or pollution and observe that impact and talk to people on the ground. So a real Aaron Brockovich comes to mind as a reference that people will know, Aaron Brockovich type approach to identifying harm and identifying who is being harmed. And over the years, grassroots organizations have formed and have begun to find their own voices and be able to reach out to organizations like the EAC and other nonprofit organizations who offer pro bono or discounted legal services so that we can talk about how BIPOC communities are, for example, 9 times more likely to live near a concentrated animal feeding operation than a privileged white community in North Carolina. There are statistics like that that you see all across the country. So you take grassroots organizations from those types of communities and you're seeing sprouts of, more than sprouts, but growth of their own voices and lawyers rather than playing center stage and being the spokesperson, instead help provide the tools that we know, that we're privileged to know through our education, and a pathway to court or a pathway to the agencies using whatever advocacy skills that we might have. So it's a totally different way to approach the problem, and it's a huge shift that's happening in the movement right now, and it's uncomfortable for people who have been doing this one way for a long time, but it's also exciting because you are finally seeing environmental laws that are on the books serve those that they haven't well, and a call for new law, which is really necessary to address those people's needs and climate change. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer.
No, it was great.
The scope of environmental law is entirely changing.
Fascinating, too. I mean, just a fascinating, like, I'm learning so much already. I feel my head going like, woo, in a really good way. So carry on, Shane. I think you had a follow-up.
Well, you know, I was just, Abby, as you were talking, I started to think, you know, first of all, when you guys were on that, riding that wagon train in, you know, with your capes fluttering in the wind. And I don't know if you noticed, but the church was in the wagon train right behind you. Because that's something we've done really well in the past, just, you know, go riding in with every good intention to save people from themselves and then screw it up because, of course, we're not operating with the people we're trying to help as the center. Now that, you know, there is some awareness of that, there's actually a lot of awareness of that in the denomination I'm working right now. So we're engaged in the work, and the work is tough. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything about what that process has been like, what you've learned, what your takeaways are. How did that work go on the ground? What were some of the initial challenges, and how did you guys deal with them?
The challenges are still alive and well. I think there are a few things. One, with diverse community representation, you have diverse community opinion. So often when we are trying, for example, to submit an amicus brief on behalf of 5 different communities, those 5 different communities will have 5 different opinions, 5 different things that they need and ways that they think the brief should be written. So all of that means we need more time. We need more time to talk. We need more time to facilitate meaningful discussion. And sometimes legal deadlines, particularly once you're in the court system, don't allow for that. So there is some planning, a significant amount of planning that has to go into getting buy-in from clients. And I would say that's even truer when you are trying to have really community-centric legal practice. So that's one. And then I think it would shock no one to know that ego is involved and that lawyers have egos, just like the rest of us, but possibly larger than the average bear.
No, because the ones who aren't in law school or in seminary.
Well, there you go. So I think the more that lawyers and law students can see themselves as a tool in a toolbox and just one tool in a toolbox, one path for change, rather than the capital T path, the better. And that we can be very flexible about the way that advocacy occurs and be very open to how we define success, because it's no longer just about a judge saying you are right, you are wrong, you win, you lose. There is a lot of really positive incremental change that you can achieve that is valuable and important, and in recognition of, particularly with things like climate change and correcting the disproportionate impact of environmental harm, it's a long journey full of many steps, and even small steps are very valuable.
Thanks, Abigail. Susan, how about you? How can you talk more about, from an artist's perspective, how you give voice to that which either has no voice or lift up the voice?
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, throughout Abby's talking, that really what artists do, as opposed to what lawyers do, is storytelling. It's storytelling of a different kind that needs to happen. And, you know, if you think back to the original creation myth, and, you know, in the Old Testament, you know, here is this man given dominion over all the plants and animals on the earth. And this particular myth has really been very instrumental in setting human beings against their environment. So what I am trying to do, and what many other artists are trying to do, is to create different stories that offer other options to this narrative and to give voice, again, to the non-human species that exist on this earth. If you think, for instance, of the recent popular book Overstory, you know, by Richard Powers, this story gives tremendous power to trees, and enables trees to have a voice. And, you know, this is happening throughout the literary world, throughout the visual art world. Another example, for instance, is, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Aviva Rahmani. She has this project called The Blue Trees, and she recently conducted a trial, and this harkens back to law, at the NYU Law School on behalf of trees as an artist, you know, with witnesses on behalf of the trees and judges, a judge and lawyers. What was powerful about it was just such a different idea. And it allowed people to think, hey, you know, this really is something we need to think about. And I think that's what art does. And that's what I'm trying to do with my work, is to say, hey, this is possible. This is interesting. This is new. You know, my creation story, in the beginning, there was only water. There isn't a human being in sight. And there isn't an apple tree. It really is a glorification of the natural world. And it begins with water, and it ends with water.
Listening to both of you respond to Shana's question, the two words that came to my mind were repair and healing. And I think, Abigail, when you are helping me see the practice of law in a different way, in the way that their efforts to center communities instead of lawyers, for example, to me, that speaks of repair and healing. So there's no question there. That's just an observation. I guess that leads me to, I'll see if I can frame this question, because it is the question I tossed out to you all in preparation for this conversation, and see what reflections you might have. But of course, Susan's done a great job in kind of telling this story of our climate crisis as being basically a picture of division of the human being from the natural world. And again, your comments, both of you, about healing and repair, about certainly about healing and repairing that division. But, and this is not original to me, people have written about, artists have created artwork about the inner division and a lot of Western, I'm talking now Western culture, the inner divide of the self, really. I mean, it's not hard to look into our culture and not see a lot of brokenness and non-integrated kinds of ways of being in the world. So that's a long way of saying, do you see connections between repairing the outer world and repairing the inner psychic spiritual world of individuals?
Absolutely.
Okay, say more.
We're both sitting here nodding, forgetting that we're doing a podcast.
Yeah, Chris, you were asking the question, and I was thinking of Jesus's line in the Gospels, you know, where he says, that which you did to the least of these, you did to me also. And I think, man, something like that really pertains to, you know, that which we do to the environment, we do to ourselves. That which we do to the environment is absolutely detrimental to that interdependent web of all existence. I mean, it literally obliterates the architecture of that interdependence. But I'm just giving our guests a minute to think about their answers, because I know they look like they were both the wheels were going. So now I'm going to back up and let you guys step in.
Go ahead, Abby.
I mean, I would say absolutely too. And I'm not sure. I've been thinking about how to answer this from a legal perspective, but I'm not going to first. I'm just going to answer this from a human perspective and kind of what I observe in my students and in our larger community. The disconnect that I see between us as people and the earth and our natural resources is a willful disconnection that we have forged over generations. But I also see it on an individual level within ourselves. The bit about Western culture is so difficult. We are raised to own things and have dominion not only over the animals and name them and tell them how to be, right? But our whole self-worth is defined by ownership. And the law also is centered around ownership. If you're not bringing a claim based on something you're entitled to own, you have no place in court. And that's a huge problem. That's why the trees can't bring a case. Because the law is all about people and what they want and what they're entitled to. And so internally, I think that severs the connection, that wanting of external things, that entitlement to things beyond ourself, severs the connection that I believe we all have with vocabulary problem, the earth, God, each other, ourselves. That's what I would say.
So I'm wondering, because I'm thinking of, you know, another group that's undervoiced is children, obviously. And we've had a couple of instances where young people have tried to bring legal suits on behalf of the environment, and they haven't been able to get a claim established. I'm wondering, you know, oh, do the parents need to bring it on behalf of their children? Do adults need to bring it on behalf of, because we own them in the eyes of the law? Like, you know, How do we get over that hurdle?
A short answer is the court has decided that it doesn't have the power to make the government change the law. So they did decide that the children did have standing in Giuliana, which is the most well-known case of its kind. Kids brought a case saying that climate change is infringing upon our right to future enjoyment of clean water and clean air. And the court said, yes, and there is persuasive evidence that climate change exists, that it is man-made. But unfortunately, the Ninth Circuit said, we can't do anything about that. It's up to the other branches of government to fix it. So it's what we'd call a redressability problem. And there'll be a lot of legal work around that case moving forward, and I'm not sure how it will land. But it is a can that I sorely wish had not been kicked in the way that it was by that court.
You are listening to What in God's Name. Our guests on this climate dialogue are Susan Hoffman Fishman, visual artist and climate activist, and Abigail Andre, environmental lawyer and professor at Vermont Law School. If you like what you are hearing, please consider sharing this show via email or social media and join us in the project of enriching our public conversations. You can join us and be sure not to miss any of our work by signing up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com. That's one word, whatingods.com. And now, back to our climate dialogue with Susan and Abby.
Yeah, I'd like to bring up just an example of using water as an example of what we're talking about. Water, instead of being a resource for everyone, is now a commodity. And, you know, it is the basis for life, basically. It's an essential to all living organisms. And making it a commodity, you know, that's bottled and shipped and divided, you know, and dammed is an example of how we're separating ourselves from what we need to survive. And, you know, it's under threat globally. It is going to be, and is actually already, the basis of war, like any other valuable commodity, like oil and spices and whatever. And, you know, these approaches to natural resources, by making them a commodity that you buy and sell, is a sense of brokenness. You know, this is, if you look at Native American culture, you'll see that, you know, they don't own land. They don't own water. You know, this is something that is supposed to be for everyone. And I think that kind of an attitude is broken.
Yeah, and I would claim that that leads to broken people, like broken individuals internally. But that's just my two cents on that question. Thank you both for your thoughtful answers to that question. I wanted to ask Sarah and or Brandon if you had a question or just a comment to participate in the conversation.
I am feeling quite honored to be here with this wealth of...
This is Sarah Ellis, who received an invitation from us to join the call, and thanks for her support on Patreon.com.
Thank all of you, Chris and Shana, for pulling this together, and Susan and Abby for adding yourselves to this. It makes me think a lot, and I have had two thoughts that I could probably articulate. One came just now, Susan, when you were talking about making water a commodity. Just in this last week, I started to learn about the Buy Nothing Project and the group of many groups of people around the world who have decided to try to exist by buying nothing, by putting a need out there and having people respond to it. It's really not like bartering. It's it's forming a community where you all help each other. And I need to learn a lot more about that. The other thing that popped up much earlier was when you were talking about law, Abby, and, you know, the lawyers ride in and bring the solution with them and give it as a gift to whoever it is that they are trying to rescue. And it made me think about some of the conversation that was happening last year when people were trying to become more aware of how to honor and think about different races and how to talk to each other, especially people who might be perceived as needing a hand up, changing the language around. Here, I'll provide this to you to tell me about yourself and tell me what it is that you perceive that you need. And that was not unlike, in my mind, how you were talking about law as well.
I see a lot of parallels between the racial justice movement and the environmental movement. And there is a bridge called the environmental justice movement that I've been talking about some without naming today, and I should have named it explicitly. But I am learning every day in this new setting, in the environmental advocacy clinic, from the amazing students at VLS. We have a very diverse student body from many different backgrounds, a racially diverse and economically diverse student body. And even just hearing them explain what they think the law means through their own eyes helps me understand and internalize the law in a better way, think more creatively about the law. And I think there are only opportunities in those kinds of conversations to create bridges and understanding and move away from the idea that I have a key and I can unlock solutions, and towards the idea that as a community, we can identify what we need that we don't already have and work together to figure out how to obtain it. Yeah, I really appreciate that observation. I think there are so many parallels between the two. I had a question for Susan. Okay. Susan, if you could tell a room full of law students something about how to be good storytellers, something about the essence of communicating the human condition through law, even though it's a different container, how would you instruct them to go about doing that? Because I think it's essential.
I think that using a variety of words that create a picture is one way of doing that. I actually wrote something down in preparation for this that I thought would be helpful, and I think it would apply to law. I mean, you can substitute the word law for what I'm going to read on water. This was written, it's an excerpt from an artist named Ronnie Horn, who is a visual artist but also a poet. And this poem is called Saying Water, and it's very long. I'm just going to read a very short part of it just to give you an idea of the way that artists create pictures and stories. So I'll just read it. Water is everywhere differently, a spiritual presence, an intimate experience, half the sky, an act of perpetual motion, familiar but elusive, troubled or calm, rough and disturbed, quiet, clear, still, cold or hot, brash or brisk, soft or hard, foul or fresh, limpid or languid, sweet, agitated, unsettled, deep, clean or filthy, a utopian substance, powerful, vulnerable, fragile, energetic, the future, a plural form, a master verb. Water reassures you, affirms you, shows you who you are, extends you out into the world, camouflages light, sighs, sucks, laughs, splishes, splashes, slashes, whooshes, murmurs, gushes, bubbles, babbles, shimmers, shines, gleams, twinkles, sparkles, blinks, winks, waves. So I guess my suggestion to you would be to think about the law in multiple ways that, you know, that show impact, that show, you know, feelings and emotions, and in a way that's similar to what Ronnie Horne has done.
Thank you.
Abigail, I'd love to throw a bone in on that question, because I think, you know, storytelling is something that we do in ministry a lot. And one can tell a story. One can invite people into a story. And I think in addition to, you know, creating those visuals by the use of, you know, using words to sort of paint a scene, there's an element that is more difficult to quantify. And good luck convincing a bunch of lawyers to do this. But in fact, our own vulnerability is our strength. So finding that passion within ourselves and allowing that, you know, obviously in a controlled, I mean, you got to have reins on it, but allowing that to then drive the story, you know, so that it's not just this sort of flat telling of a story, but that it really, it remember those books you had when you were a little kid, you turned the page and the thing popped up, it sort of becomes three-dimensional in the speaker, if the speaker is willing to be three-dimensional by opening to their own vulnerability or their own connection, their own passion to the story.
I have another thought. I once taught an American history class through images, and it was a very interesting experience because the images that were portrayed in some historical paintings and photographs told the story the way that the writers, which were male, wanted the story to be told. And I would think it would be very interesting to use images to show how law evolved, how it's regarded through images throughout the centuries. I think it would give students an idea of what has occurred before that has influenced what has happened now.
That makes me, what it makes me think about is Chris's question earlier about power. And, you know, in this country and any other country with laws like ours, nobody had power until the law said it, you did. Women didn't. Men didn't of any race other than white. And for now, trees don't either. But around the world, that's changing. Here, we are behind. But you do see cases in international settings with standing for natural resources. And so, you know, I think it's easy, wearing my artist hat in particular, to throw our hands up sometimes about the state of the law in this country, the state of politics in this country, because it is so frustrating. And right now feels like we're moving backwards. But if you look at the evolution of law through images or any other way, you do see flashpoints of major progress that was human made. And depending on how much hope I have on a given day, I do believe that we are capable of moving the law in the direction it has to go, absolutely has to go, in order to facilitate these young people's cases, cases on behalf of natural resources. And we are not there yet. But storytelling and community-focused lawyering is a central part of success and really changing the seat of power to be more inclusive. So yeah, that does resonate. And it is hopeful to remember that the law is an imperfect man-made creature, but that it can change.
Images also show the ideal function of the law, what we aspired it to be, which is always good to come back to.
I feel humbled by this conversation in a beautiful way. I'm so grateful to you both. And I say humbled because there are things both of you said that I don't understand, not because you didn't make sense, but because my sensibility isn't big enough yet to hold what you've offered. So I say that all in gratitude for you and for this time.
You know, when we were putting the series together, Chris, we were thinking about, you know, what would make a conversation about climate change different. We wanted to come at it, you know, to put some sort of a fresh throw on it. And so we decided on this interdisciplinary approach by, you know, bringing people together who are coming at this thing from different places. This is now the second show that we've recorded. And I think I'm starting to figure out that, like, God is intersectionality and the thing which connects each to each and each to all, because what we think of sometimes as disparate disciplines suddenly reveal themselves to have a whole lot in common. So that's been really illuminating today. And they may not just inherently have stuff in common, but they have a lot to offer one another, you know. So that's been insightful today. And also thank both Susan Hoffman Fishman and Abigail Andre for spending this time with us.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon, and we invite you to join our generous donors on Patreon in supporting What in God's Name. And I join Shana again to thank Susan and Abigail for joining us in this conversation. And you can sign up for our newsletter on our website, whatingods.com, which is Shana,
WHATINGODS.
It's always fun to try to do that on Zoom.
It is. I love delays.
See you next time.
Thanks again, folks. Always good to be with you, Chris.